So I'll start off by, since we're defining the room according to document people and space people, I guess sort of the red and blue states, I'm probably purple. Okay, I'm going to represent the purple crowd. I do document work to some extent, and I was trained as an numerical analyst, so I can identify hopefully with the space people. But part of my career has been is on the edge, is trying to help both sides understand the needs, because it's very good to do great mathematics, but when one uses it, that's not good. It's very good to have good user models, but we have to understand what mathematics can, or what we can compute, what we can't compute. So I think hopefully you'll get some aspect of that in this presentation. This has a little bit of everything in there. I am a computer scientist, but looking at text mining for the past almost two decades of different forms, and today I'm going to talk with you some of the work that we're doing. Also try to reflect on what we've heard this morning. Michael did a great job of setting a good framework for vector space and so forth. But I'm going to talk a little bit about differences on interpretation of those factors, which we alluded to earlier. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what motivates us. It's important to have, if we're doing applications, what motivates it. Enron did great things for data mining. if you don't believe it, those of us in the room who've been working with it, you're not going to get this kind of opportunity that walks in the door to have that.
Hopefully.
But who knows? We might get more. Share with you, if you're not aware of this data set, just to share with you some of the what you could do with it and how it's helping us a lot in data mining. And share with you a different approach to factorizations. We heard about latent semantic indexing earlier in Michael's talk. Talk about another area that's moving from very well known in image processing and image analysis over into the text mining field, and that is the idea of exploiting the non-negativity that these problems normally have in terms of those frequency counts we mentioned earlier. So we'll talk about non-negative matrix factorization. And then, no, I do not work directly for the Bush administration, but we were promoting ideas related to surveillance way before it hit the press and things. And no, I do not know exactly what they're doing in the NSA, but I'll show you what we've been able to do. Okay. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the background. Of course, there was an investigation of Enron, as you well know, and you're hearing about the latest prosecutions going on. It was certainly the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Corporation, was able to acquire. I don't know if that's all the email messages, certainly, but certainly a huge volume, 50 million email messages out of the corporate entities, and those are the accounts that were set up in their Outlook or whatever email system that they were based. But I can't tell you if that certainly was the total number. It's probably much larger than that. There's been different instances of this corpus out there. A lot of people are looking at what Bill Cohen has done at CMU. He's done a very nice job. That group has done a very nice job of sort of doing some cleansing and cleaning up of that set. And I encourage you to, or you may do a Google search on Enron, you probably might want to start from the CMU perspective first, although there are multiple versions floating around. And that's another problem we have in text mining, is standardization and agreements on where we start from. Okay, and that's something we do need to improve on. Okay, so maybe I'll harp on that a little later. But this set had, this curated set, this cleaned up set, has about 500,000 email messages, and they span a larger time frame than what's represented there, but the majority of the email messages, and I'm talking about the date sent, okay, not necessarily what they're referring to, but the date sent is 1999 to 2001. And keep in mind, 2001 is the magical year of Enron going under, all right? And we'll get back to that. Okay, so it's important to have some historical information because we're going to end up talking about topic detection later. And so I try to set the stage of what are people looking for in text? And if we're doing surveillance and things, or we're looking at monitoring for this particular data set, there were certain things that were going on. They were having certainly international affairs as well as national affairs. There's problems with the setting up of companies across the seas, for example, with the Dabno Power Company. Certainly close to the heart of a lot of people in this room, perhaps, the deregulation of the California energy industry, which led to the blackouts. So there's a lot of interest discussion of mining, that kind of information. And of course, the biggies, just the deceptive accounting. Although Arthur Andersen was cleared, Lay and Skilling, I don't think they're gonna get off that easy. But the collapse is in October 2001, and of course they filed for bankruptcy in 2001. So I'm just setting the stage historically. There are certain events that, that you want to be able to track in this kind of data set. So that's just quickly just the stage. Now I'm going to talk about the fundamentals that we're looking at, this different kind of model that, that we haven't talked about yet, and this idea of exploiting the natural frequencies that, that you get from text mining and the association of terms and documents. And this is non-negative matrix factorization. So the idea here is to exploit that non-negativity, that whether you apply term frequencies to construct the weights that, that Michael showed you, or he showed you mutual information, a common one we use a lot is log entropy, where we do a log-based local frequency weight, and then we do entropy. Global weights is a very common way, because the entropy is very useful for discriminators. And I've got some formulas up coming up later if you're interested to see what those look like. But irrespective of that, you're looking at some non-negative representation of high-dimensional data. And that's one way of looking at something as an alternative to those orthogonal factorization schemes, such as SVD, which have those negative components that we have a hard time interpreting. So one of the entry point, I would say, to the popular literature, certainly the non-negative matrices have been talked about in linear algebra for many, many years. It predates the 1990s. But I think the seminal paper that really got people excited was this paper in Nature. And if you want to make an impact in the world, publish in journals like Nature, okay? Not SciEn journals, which, you know, the readership is very low. You publish in Nature and everybody sees it. So Lee and Sung published in Nature a wonderful article that illustrated this concept of sum by parts. And the original connotation, I think, makes a lot of sense for image analysis, but now we're just starting to understand, I think, what that means for text mining, okay, in document space. That perhaps what we need to look at is better relationships between the basis vectors and the original document space, and we were getting at that before the break. We were almost getting there in terms of, well, what does that dimension mean? Maybe sometimes it's important, and then maybe sometimes it's not. Maybe sometimes for different reasons I don't want to know. It needs to be incorporated. And if you don't believe me, there are applications where it's very important not to know what the dimensions are, okay? But that's not what I'm talking about today. Today, in this aspect, I really would like to have an understanding of what does that dimension mean to me, or should I pay attention to it? So look, I'm gonna show you a picture in a minute, illustrate what they meant by sum of parts. But the idea is to do feature extraction and interpretation. This kind of an approach was compared with traditional SVD, latent semantic indexing, for some fundamental retrieval tasks on some very typical, your med line, your Cranfield, your, you know, those regular benchmark sets, which we've hit on for years. Zhu et al. Did a good job in 2003 pointing out that you really could do better if you could interpret the features more so than the SVD, okay, for some curated data sets. So this is the kind of picture that comes from the Lee and Sung article that was published in Nature, which really gives you this idea of the sum of parts from sort of an interesting perspective of matrices and images here. I know it's hard to probably to see in the back there, but what we're looking at here are two factorizations of image data. So the original matrix here is representative of an image, in this case of a face, and we're looking at the use of black and white pixels here, different levels from 0 to 1 of darkness here to represent, you know, a face. And so what you see up here are two different representations, two factorizations, mind you, of that original data for low rank representations. And so the traditional SVD approach, which we actually talked about before, which Michael's showing you, here would be a representation of those factors, which if you recomputed the low rank approximation, you know, if you went to the full rank, you would hopefully reconstruct the original image. And of course, the idea behind this or principal components is to see how much of the information of the original image could you retain by taking D or K or whatever the variable is, the first the D-dimensional singular subspace. In other words, the largest singular values in vectors. But the thing that's important to realize is that each of these basis vectors that you get back really have sort of global support in the sense that those vectors are dense.
So what exactly are you actually doing an SVD of? We have the image. You break it up into boxes, or what?
Yes, I mean, you would, just like in the term, in the incidence of term and frequencies, you would have to partition the image in rows and columns, and then go ahead and factor that image space out the same way. Okay. a pixel just being colored, whether where we would put a frequency in there for a term or a time.
So you're looking at the image as a matrix?
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
Exactly. Do it in MATLAB. I mean, nothing's, this is not classic image processing here. It's just illustrating, the point is to illustrate that those dense vectors that you get for the SVD really are showing you that there's a component in every field, okay? In every dimension, there's something there. I mean, it could be zero, but very unlikely.
Perhaps you shouldn't go so fast. I mean, in the text situation, I know how it's done.
Yes.
The matrix, and if the terms are words, then for each document, I write what the frequency is,
mm-hmm.
and I have as many columns as there are documents, and as many rows as this. I don't understand what I do for image. Is that levels of darkness that play the role?
Yes,
and
just scales of gray.
How much gray there is in what? In one column?
Well, no, we represent it in reconstructing on a pixel per pixel basis.
So your matrix is the image?
Yes, the matrix is the image. That's what we were just talking about.
But when I talk about this, the latent semantic indexing,
yes.
I was talking about a collection of documents.
Yes.
So what's the collection here?
Well, I'm going to get to it in a second.
Good. That's why
I'm not stopping here. I'm just trying to give you where the entry point of the method is most likely been seen up to this point in this world. And now we're going to look at what exploiting non-negativity and factorization means for us. But I just wanted to point out that this idea of sum by parts allows you in the factors of the NMF to look at isolated components of the image. So for example, If I take increasing numbers of the SVD to reconstruct the image, even after four or five dimensions, you get a rough outline of a face. That won't happen with NMF. You might get all of an ear. You might get all of a nose. You might get all of an eye. So that the summability is what's important in NMF. So for feature identification extraction. And the question is that something we should buy off in text model? What do we gain by that?
So let me just clarify what is up on the slide right now. So that U is basically a bunch of basis vectors.
Yes.
And that has been created perhaps by looking at many images of faces.
Sure, yes.
And then that particular originally is showing us its representation is that sigma V.
This is reconstructing the low rank model.
Right, right. So in other words, the left side is fixed by a collection of images. Colored sigma V matrix.
These are the coefficients, right. These represent the coefficients that you would then to reconstruct the original columns.
What I don't get is, so take one of those boxes. Is that box supposed to represent the entire image, or is that supposed to be repeated in blocks? Does that say that lower?
Depends on how you segmented the original. I mean, this is out of their paper, but this is just depending upon how they decided to segment that image, okay, in terms of how many block columns you'll have. Because it still is pixelated here, okay? It's not.
No, I understand. But no, so I can't really tell. But if I look at, let's say, the lower right block, is that if I saw that as pixels, does that have the same number of pixels as the original image?
You have
49
dimensions,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Seven by seven.
So why don't you just say the algorithm and you won't have any questions?
I'm getting there. Watch this. It's gone. Okay, that was their work. Okay. This is what you get when you try to explain other people's work. Okay. But that's not my work. What we have done, or what has been done, and this is the segue, is to look at the fact that if we can produce a factorization of document term matrices, what we should be able to see, perhaps, is this idea of features from a word sense and looking at extractions of highly weighted terms from these non-negative vectors. So this is what you're going to see is the ability to perhaps pull out of the basis vector itself representations of words that have semantic meaning. You can't do that with the SVD, at least not in a very obvious way. Okay? So that's the idea. So let's get to the math. Okay. All right. So start off with a representation, very much like Michael had, of a matrix representing, in this case, in the context of email, it might be termed by messages or token by messages or however you decide to parse. And of course, we've already pointed out that this is a sparse matrix. Not every word will occur, hopefully. And so the idea here is to factorize this matrix in an approximate way. And so the key word here, notice the little mathematical notation, it's not an equal sign, it's an approximate. We will give something up that the SVD was guaranteed to do, and that was the Eckhart and Young result of the best fit. And Michael alluded to that, that the SVD would give you the best fit to the original matrix in low rank space. We're going to give that up a little bit. But what we're going to gain is the fact that we don't have any negative components in these factors. So these matrices here, as we'll see here, will represent a constraint optimization as opposed to the unconstrained optimization that we were seeing before. So now what we're trying to do is to find a best fit to this association matrix, this sparse matrix of terms and documents, such that the components are non-negative. And now this is, again, not necessarily a new idea. We had a workshop many years ago, and Kahan was there and said, hello, why are you not looking at these representations? And of course, we're a little slow, but now we come to realize that, well, yeah, we should look at non-negativity explicitly, not just from a standpoint of using what software we have available, you know, from Linpack and Icepack and LAPack and so forth. So here we're looking at what can we gain from looking at explicit representations of non-negativity. And the idea is to hopefully we will get some, looking at algorithms that can produce better estimates, because I'm going to show you later on is we'll have hopefully the ability to represent, we'll have meaning of what the columns of the W's are semantically, and then the H matrix will be the coefficient matrix that will help tell us how those features are spanned. So we'll actually have a one-to-one sort of association between features being described and then how they are spanned by the original document set, i.e., can I find an ear or nose in image processing? Can I find a topic in my document space and tell you pretty much with some confidence is it, how well is it represented?
And the optimization problem, as you stated here, is with R fixed beforehand.
Absolutely. So the original work, again, I'm going to show you different presentations of the material, sort of past and present. This is a past representation of Lee and Sung in the Nature article. This is how they showed a very simple multiplicative update method. It's nothing really fancy here to look at this alternating type of iteration of trying to constrain the W and the H in a very, very simplistic way with initial, you know, starting off with some initial guess at WH. That turns out to be a little bit of an interesting research question in itself. Is what you know? Should that necessarily be a random matrix? Because you'll see in the literature, a lot of times they're initialized with a random W rank. Not necessarily. Okay. If you had a low rank approximation available from some other best guess, those of you in iterative methods, it's almost like preconditioning. If you have sort of an estimate of a good preconditioning of a W or H, it's probably worth trying. Okay. But typically they will start with some random guess and then scale for unit norm, and then you'll iterate with some convergence criteria. There's a couple of different issues there about how that should be done. But a lot of time in practice, people are just running up to a certain number of iterations and stopping. Because as I'll show you, there's some interesting research questions on convergence. Okay. So there is wonderful problems here to be solved from the mathematics standpoint, as well as the implementation. So that's, again, 1999. And of course, for stability, because you are doing a division there, sometimes you have to have a slight perturbation to make it trackable. So it's important to normalize it initially, and then basically, as written about, what the optimization is doing, it's really optimizing on a unit hypersphere, and effectively you're mapping those, what I call these the feature vectors, or the columns of the W matrix. Again, it's the W times the H is the factorization we're after. Those are effectively mapped to the surface. So you keep repeatedly normalizing to force that to happen. And the cost of doing that is Kira's pointing out, if you fix that rank, then you're looking at an order of RMN operations per iteration. And Lee and Sung did prove in their work that, you know, with this multiplicative update, you will get convergence of a monotonic but non-increasing fashion, provided this is what you're looking to measure, the Frobenius norm is what you're measuring. So one perspective, again, from an alternative view, from someone from an optimization perspective, they would say, well, hello, what you really could look at this as sort of a diagonally scaled gradient descent map. That's another alternative way. So again, we could have different discussions depending upon who you are, but that would be a correct assessment. Now, the issue of the approximation means, you know, you threw out uniqueness probably, and the answer is yeah, we do throw out uniqueness. And there are techniques that people are trying to use to try to force some optimality in the representations and perhaps in the process forcing some uniqueness out. And Hoyer is one particular person that's done this from more of a neural network standpoint. It's this idea of enforcing statistical sparsity. So the first in the morning we were talking about this issue of sparsity and, you know, is sparsity bad or good? So I can assure you there's many applications in the world where people want sparse bases of sparse matrices. Okay. So it's an interesting problem of its own. So one way is to find techniques that might, for example, enforce statistical sparsity on the H matrix and force a uniqueness out or a particular kind of data representations of W. And so the imaging people have been playing with this for a long time. How to enforce sparsity on the coefficient matrix, because maybe they say there's something about the number of ways you could span features in the image or so forth. And so this is a paper that suggested regularization as an approach to achieve statistical sparsity in the coefficient matrix. And this is sort of a point count regularization approach, a penalty method, right? It's just fundamental ways of penalizing the number of non-zeros in H rather than the sum of all the values. So what is the goal? Why do I care? Well, hopefully, and we've shown in some of our work, this is one of my master's students, former master's students, is that we might be able to get better representations, better identification of features, if we can increase the sparsity and control the sparsity of the H matrix. Again, it's almost like saying, you know, how many features should I have, and then how many features are you allowed to have to describe something? It's kind of an interesting problem. The work we've been doing with colleagues at Wake Forest, Bob Clemens and Paul Palka, is to look at, again, alternative ways of controlling this convergence and looking at sparsity in the factors by looking at a combination of a multiplicative update and a constrained least squares approach. So what we've been looking at is, yeah, do your iteration step like you'd like to do with the traditional gradient descent method, and then, you know what, why not look at a way of computing that weight matrix in a constrained way? In other words, what we're looking at is some penalty method for smoothness in H or in W, as you'll see later. You could enforce smoothness. Smoothness will be like looking at an L2 norm constraint on H. But where I wrote H, you could write W. And this is an interesting aspect of research. What do you get from constraining either factor? Do you constrain both? What does it mean? And it turns out it's different across application. What works for images may not be appropriate for textbooks. Okay. And so here's an open problem. When you start doing this, right, when you start constraining and penalizing those factors, you might get convergence to a stationary point, but you can't necessarily guarantee it's certainly a global minimum of any sort. So there's a lot of open questions about constraining these penalty, constructing these penalty methods and guaranteeing convergence. Okay. So here's an algorithm. Here's what we would do. Again, starting off like multiplicative update, initialize your initial factors, scale the unit norm, and do the traditional updates as you would. But here's the alternative, right? Is to force, look at penalty methods that will enforce, for example, some sort of sparsity constraint. In this case, we call this a smoothness constraint. On this case, the H matrix, but I could reformulate this for the W. The original connotation from imaging, this is what they were looking at, to try to force out perhaps uniqueness in a W if you had to penalize the H. And of course, now guess what? You've entered another parameter. And that's typically what's going to happen with this method. So now you have a lambda parameter to deal with. All right, so
One of the two means L2 norm.
Yes.
What are the other two?
Just squares.
But that is the L2 norm.
Yeah, I know.
So
that
why do we have two of them?
LaTeX. Square delta. Oh, it is square delta. I'm sorry. Really? Oh, you're asking those two. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Square delta. My bad. So what's interesting with these penalty methods is that it forces, and when you're doing this constraint optimization, you cannot allow negative values. So this is an interesting problem. If looking at these kinds of constraints on the sparsity, but what you may end up doing is producing negative values to achieve that result, and then you may have to force those values to zero. So this is a very interesting aspect of research here too, is finding ways, better ways, and Hoyer's looked on some of this work, and finding better ways to do the penalty, but not to force things to zero inside the iteration, because once that value and that component is forced to zero, it will never turn back to positive.
I'm getting this feeling from looking at this equation that you said that if you fix an R, then this is the procedure.
Yes.
So if I have it done for R and now I want to do it for R plus one.
Yes.
Are some of the things you computed reusable?
No, you're going to run this up to a certain number. I don't have an R here. I have the K. You're going to run this up to K.
Right, but the dimensionality.
Dimensionality. What I'm thinking is like,
Just like in data mining and clustering, you will define basis, you know, the size of the basis that you're generating.
Right. No, but I'm talking about another issue, namely that if I wanted to compute the R plus one rank approximation of this or whatever, does the fact that I've already computed the R approximation help me in some way get a head start?
Yes, we think so, and that's another area of research is looking at updating techniques, making that decision of leaping from one dimension to another.
Okay.
We haven't explicitly written that paper yet, but that's a good point. People have not done that. I haven't seen it written up yet. So let's talk about taking this and now doing something with it. Okay. So in this vastness of email, there's a lot of different ways of organizing information. And some of the models that people have looking at are taking all the emails. And for example, what you've got extracted from all of these emails is the folders that these users or these accounts had. Okay. And so they're based on the mail system that they were using. They were traditional Outlook kind of folders, inbox, outbox, sent items, things like that. Okay, so about 150 accounts. I know some of these accounts are duplicates representing the same user more than once, a few of them. But what we looked at is just a very simple parsing. We put distributing a text parser. It's nothing, all that extravagant, but it has allowed people, at least in academia, to do token extraction, build sparse matrices, actually do the SVD if they want, and we've been shipping it worldwide, and I'll give you a website at the end if you'd like to play with it. And we allow the user to produce a stop list. We had a stop list that we used for these experiments, and made the assumption that we extract terms that appear in more than one email, or more than once globally. And that's another whole issue right there, in terms of singletons and allowing word frequencies and so forth. But this is one approach. So another aspect was to look at the fact that, when people organize their email, there's not a method of madness here. They actually build folders, and they put things from home in a particular folder, or things from the boss in another folder, and things like that. So we did look at parsing directories that were not from the standard default folders associated with the mailer. In other words, they had to create a folder. So that's very useful information. And certainly in data mining, we shouldn't ignore that. If the users or the subjects have done something, we should exploit that. And so this is one thing that we did. We call this the private collection, because they've privately defined folders, and we parse exclusively those and not things sitting in their inboxes. So the distribution of messages through the year 2001, looks something like this. We noticed that things tail off. This is the bankruptcy, and so there's different activities and different terms. The dictionaries change slightly. I'm looking at these independently, just parsing on a monthly basis. I'm not looking at overlaps necessarily there. And you can see that there's different levels of activities, but largely these aren't huge. They're not huge.
Terms are words?
Yes. From our text parser. Okay. Now let's follow up a little bit more discussion from this morning about term weighting and give you some other, just adding on to what Michael had already done. This idea of looking at certainly frequencies, local frequencies and global frequencies, and perhaps there's needs to normalize so that you make sure that your document vectors are normalized if you so choose. You don't have to, but you could. And certain literatures full of different descriptions of this. You could have a very simple term frequency years ago, going back to Cornell and other places that codified ways of specifying frequencies, which I thought was very effective, sort of coming up with little acronyms that represent what the what the weighting scheme was. TXX would be term frequency, but no global weighting and no normalization, or LEX, which would be a logarithmic type local frequency here, taking the, this is the frequency Michael was showing before, and we'll just take a log transform of the shift, and then here's here's a use of entropy for more of a global assessment of the distribution or the probability of relationship between a term and across all of the documents.
Where n is equal to what?
N would be, in this case, the number of documents. And so it's interesting, a lot of applications, this is what people want to look at. They really could care less here. They'd like to see sort of what are the entropy weights that have come across mm-hmm. all of the dictionary. So what a good thing to do is after you've parsed and you build your data structure, you know, it'd be nice for you to sort of have those global weights available because you might exploit that in some way. Again, as discriminators, right? That's what we're looking at, information content. And from information theory, entropy is used a lot in those aspects. So you can do probabilistic methods with these types of transforms. But as Michael said, there's a whole slew of here. I'm just showing you two possible ones. We played with both of these in this study. All right. So this is something that we initially played with, this very simple penalty method approach to approximizing this NMF. And so what was the magic R here? We took 50. So we decided 50 features was something that we thought might be useful. We actually scaled down to a smaller number of features, but 50 seemed reasonable. Doing it on very modest processors, we're using faster machines now, but we first did this on an UltraSpark 2, run about 100 iterations of the NMF method to approximate the X, and this is sort of the different sizes of the dictionaries and the number of mail messages that were associated with those two different collections. But what's surprising, for that particular method, with penalizing the sparsity on the coefficient matrix, we didn't get that much difference. For example, what I mean by that is that when you have a larger penalty in your sparsity constraint, certainly you're giving up accuracy. Definitely you're giving up accuracy in the weighting of the original error, right? But you'd like to see an improvement in the sparsity of the H, and hopefully your computation time would go down. But you know, that's not really... I mean, it's significant, but it's not that significant. I mean, to go in terms of seconds from 1,500 seconds down to 1,471. So it seemed like penalizing the H matrix, the coefficient matrix, although they may be viable in the imaging world, isn't doing much for us in the text world here. And then the same thing over here with this private collection. So, but what you can get out, even with this very crude model of penalizing the H, I'll show you some penalizing W in a second, is this is what comes out. You're able to approximate these original vectors here, okay, with the columns of this. What you will do, what you have the capability of doing now is keep in mind all of those vectors are non-negative, and you have coefficients, or i.e. corresponding rows of the H, to tell you how to define columns over here of X by spans of those non-negative columns in W, right? And the question then is, all right, can you now interpret what the W is? Or maybe, you know, you had the U matrices before in the SVD. You couldn't really do anything. Well, now, what you could look at is just, you could threshold on those elements, if you like, by some threshold or rank, take a certain number of rank of words. And this is an illustration of, say, for example, this is a 50 rank model, and I picked out 10, 23, and the 26. So I'm picking out the 10th column here, then I'm picking out the 23rd column, and I'm picking out the 26th column, and I just sort on the dominant weights of that vector.
Is this still the Enron corpus?
Yes.
The fantasy football is Enron corpus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is why we got the New York Times, by the way. The New York Times wrote an article because we could.
California just means stuff which talks about California.
Right, but these acronyms obviously mean something. Is that Southern California? So I don't know what that means, but actually I think I know what it means now from the association.
Well,
so
SC is a company.
Okay.
Yeah.
SC is Southern California.
Is an
energy
company.
The point is, these are the dominant terms associated with that feature, and it's pretty much right on the money. If we go back and then the point here is that if this is a representation of context, then I can look at the coefficient matrix here to tell me who over here is span that, and now I have a clustering algorithm. I have a way of looking at the context here, just like I identified an ear, perhaps, I've identified a feature. Now can I go back and find out the emails, or at least some of the emails?
I just want to understand this. The name California is given
by human beings. Absolutely. I'm sorry. Yes, I apologize. This obviously is a human decision.
Yeah, exactly. They look at this cluster, and it's all about California.
Absolutely. And I think that brings up an excellent point. A lot of what we're doing is more, I would argue, decision support. We are still not, at least I'm not going to claim that we're at the point that we do absolute classifications, and you're willing to take me, construct a sentence
so
from these.
So if you're looking for where they tied you screwed California,
yes.
Then you don't know where that is, right? You have to look at all the clusters.
You have
still by eye,
right,
or something.
But if you told me that if a graphical user interface was designed, that you told me I want to look at 5-10 words to describe something, and you would be able to do that. We would have a capability of doing that for you. Now, granted, if we there's
and,
issues.
And I would, as a human being, look at these vectors.
Yes.
I mean, what you have there.
Yes.
And decide, this is suspicious.
Exactly.
This might very well be what I'm interested
right.
in.
I mean, this one was bizarre. When this came out, we're going, EVP, Fortune, Britain, Woman, CEO, Avon, what in the world? It's Louis Kitchen. So we had to go back. The name wasn't there, but certainly the aspect of her was there. As my colleague Murray would say, the aboutness of her is there. It's just the specific literal definition of what the feature is. You know, I don't know. This one was great. Okay, and some users look at it and go, I have no idea what that is. Well, but that's a wide receiver, that's a quarterback, that's a running back.
The decomposition of
That is true. In other words, if you start with a W, but on average, we would see, even though we ran with different, it's not written here, but, there it is. We ran with different R's. We would still get similar features. Maybe we'd lose a feature here or lose a feature there.
But you can have the rotation.
Yes.
You can also insert between W and S, the X time, X minus 1.
Oh, doing slight perturbations, you're saying? Or
no, you do the rotations.
Rotations?
Yeah, you can have infinite solution. Then how can you have a very unique interpretation?
Well, of course, that's why I'm saying this is an approximate factorization. I never claim uniqueness.
No, but in that case, but you have a very unique interpretation of the
language. Oh, of course, yes. I mean, but in surveillance, I mean, the idea of looking at surveillance is just trying to look at an idea of a context to see if it makes any sense to you.
So my question is whether or not you get that happening because you're lucky or not, because you're lucky you get it? Or
no, not at all. I mean, if you put 1,000 here, I would grant you. I mean, do you want to look through 1,000 vectors? But I mean, this gets back to what Michael was saying earlier. I mean, it's the curse of dimensionality, and how much dimensionality can you afford to identify something that's meaningful?
Yeah.
I mean, no one has solved that problem.
Yeah, right? But you got that kind of language, because it's based on the fact that you look at the vector H, right?
But no, we're interpreting the W, and then the H will give you the clusters.
Yeah, but in that way, you have infinite W and X. You're infinite.
You're saying infinite?
Yeah.
I guess I'm totally missing what you mean by
that.
I think that he's saying that you would stick an orthogonal matrix between the W and H, and that wouldn't change the norms of W and H, and that makes the coefficients, I think, that's what
he's an orthogonal matrix or something inside? Sure.
I guess perhaps you should clarify that this is sort of post hoc analysis. You ran it, you got something, and just looking at it.
Yes.
And this falls in the category where Gary said earlier, if you don't know what you're looking for,
I can't help
No, then this helps you because this says these are the kinds of things that
no,
are
but
in
if,
there.
If these don't mean anything to you, though, I can't infer any knowledge for you.
But on the other hand, I guess your question is if you're looking for documents about California, will you find a single nice cluster about them? Probably not.
Right.
But you can get it based on luck, though.
Sorry?
You can get that casting based on the fact that you're lucky.
Well,
but
you're lucky.
Because you have infinite number of W and S matrices. Right? The decomposition is not unique.
Like taking a random projection, I guess, is what you're sort of saying.
I think maybe the issue you bring up is that if you took your W vector for a particular document.
Yes.
And you distributed, say it's about two of these topics, and you distributed across four topics.
Yes.
And then split those two topics in half to make four, and you can get back the exact same reproduction of the term frequencies. But I think your regularization helps here.
That's right.
In that case, because you're enforcing some kind of sparsity.
Right. But I see what you're getting.
Yeah, non-uniqueness is unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have to find some techniques. Regularization is one way to try to force uniqueness out. But then there's the convergence issue. But we only run a certain number of durations and stop anyway. And again, how you determine cluster sizes, all I'm doing here is, again, we go through and we sort of determine, you know, how many elements will we use above some threshold. And again, that's another source of decision-making, is how to make that discernment of who gets in the cluster and who doesn't. That's, you know, another interesting problem. Here's another example of, this is, I think before I was showing you, go back, this was looking at, okay, this is just me going a little bit farther down. I picked out 33, 34, and 39. And what was very interesting is you saw the fantasy football. That was really a cluster of fantasy football. And if you're fantasy football, you're assembling a team, you're tracking the statistics of players, and you want to create this, you know, ungodly team that'll never exist because you never could afford it. And then this is clearly Texas football. And that was very interesting, that we could actually get a feature that described a similar context, I mean, a similar piece of knowledge, but in a different context. So this was college football discussion versus the fantasy football. And then, of course, there's things on FastDial and shareholders and lay, and messages dealing more with the collapse. And then here's that. Remember I talked about the overseas?
Yes.
There it is. Feature comes right out. And you can track 235 emails. Again, the point is just to say, show me where to look. Just, and I use the analogy in class with students, like, you know, you go to the department store and they have the cameras. Some poor soul is sitting there looking at screens all day long. You know, I mean, we need that ability. You know, just say, I'm not interested in incriminating anybody. I'm not interested in going to that particular email, you know, going for that email message. Well, maybe some people in the government are, but all we're looking at is the ability to say, is the topic there? Is the discussion there? And how pervasive is it? Okay. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah, you couldn't find an email in a hairspin. In other words, if somebody was had one email which is very incriminating,
we're not. Serendipity, maybe. Serendipity, maybe. Right, absolutely. So this was, we were written up in the New York Times, and this is sort of this is what was put in the New York Times to sort of illustrate what we were doing. This is before the Bush administration, at least their news. Again, I don't claim anything to do with that, but what we could do through time then is actually go back and, you know, when the writers were formulating our data, you know, they were putting these dots in here and not really knowing what a dot is, but what we're looking there is features. I mean, again, we're going back and looking at those feature vectors and trying to decide here is a topic of discussion, and we can track that topic of discussion with that coefficient matrix. And so no one understands there's any mathematics going on here, but present it to the user. Here's an interface that actually shows the transect of discussions. And for example, it's sort of interlaced here, January, February, March, April, May, June, all the way through December, and you can sort of see the highlight of the discussions. More features are being extracted on California Energy and trailing off towards the end of the company. And then, of course, the bankruptcy, this is exactly what you'd expect knowing what we know about Enron. This was kind of interesting. Here's college football, spring practice, we think, and then here's, you know, getting ready for the season. And then here, yeah, there's football, all right, but there are four features of fantasy. And notice how the fantasy corresponds to the, well, I guess there's nothing else to do, so we might as well do fantasy. So presented to a user, mathematics, I mean, again, no one understands, I mean, you know, they have no idea what we're doing, but if we can present this type of ability to do these factorizations in a way with this kind of interface, people can go, aha, all right. And then at any given point, you could then, you know, expand any one of these dots and then go in, perhaps, and do more sophisticated text mining and data mining. Now maybe you want to take those isolated clusters and expand them and do an LSI or do some type of other hyperlink analysis or a graph and consider a graph. But we have to have abilities of getting aboutness from streams and huge collections very quickly. And again, this was just one representation of what surveillance with this idea of
But that is not exactly there. How do you
the features. Again, the feature vectors, there's 50 features I've generated. And if we can identify, again, and I say in some way,
across
what was
the collection, how often feature 5 was
right.
active.
Right. Now, let's get back to this uniqueness issue. So there's nothing novel about what I showed you before. It was just penalizing the age. And as I showed you computationally, we really didn't get that much of an advantage for it. Well, you can generalize it, and this is being done, especially in spectral data analysis and imaging applications. They actually penalize not just the W, but they penalize the W and H, or maybe some combination of it. And I'm not going to go into that, but you can read in their literature. There's different motivations for doing this, depending upon the sources of data or the materials involved. It has a lot to do with the kind of materials that are involved. And what I wanted to play with was, well, it'd be very interesting to look at what does sparsifying your feature representations by. So in other words, there's this other interesting aspect. How many words does it take to define a feature? You know, it's kind of an interesting problem there. So this is an idea of a modification of the traditional multiplicative algorithm. Now we call this CNNF, constrained NMF. And so now you're constraining perhaps both an alpha and beta, or you know, set one to zero and then just constrain the other. And so now you have to change your multiplicative update to a counter to accomplish that correction. Okay? And here's what happened. Here's the first experiment. I just want to show you something. What we did is we ran that original penalty method that I showed you before with that lambda parameter and constraining the H factor. And then I turned around and said, all right, let's constrain the W. Okay, everybody with me? I'm going to constrain the W instead of the H. What's the difference? Okay. And alpha represents that regularization parameter on the W. This was my original one. So we did that. We took 50 features. And I asked, and Murray, the colleague working with me, he's an information scientist, and he interprets, which is great. It's another issue in data mining. Partner with people from other domains that can help you. So he was able to look at some of these features for me. And what I asked him to do was say, all right, look at those features coming out. Identify the high entropy words. So we look at the highest entropy words. Remember the entropy values, the global weights that we talked about before. It's kind of interesting to hold on to those values. And I asked him, find those words out of those features, all right, and tell me what they're about. What clusters, for example, are they associated with in our email set? And what was interesting is that constraining the H did very little of anything of these very high entropy words. These, again, are the highest entropy words. This is the very highest one. Some of you know what this stuff is. I don't. Obviously, I know what a rebate is. But there's a lot of proper nouns in some of the stuff and more general things. Names, text, University of Texas, things like that, stocks, chronicle, whatever, blackouts. But when we constrain on the W with different levels of constraint, for example, this is the highest constraint, one of the highest constraints I ran, which means this is a very sparse representation. These are denser, okay?
Now, what do those numbers mean? 4, 2, 2, et cetera?
Okay, I'm getting there. Okay. Can't work hard enough here. Okay, so first I'm just trying to explain what they are, then I'll get the numbers. All right, so first of all, these are the regularization parameters. This is a sparser model, as far as a higher constraint. I must have a sparser W than here. The values here are the frequencies of those words in features. Okay, go across all the features that are represented by this model. And I want to know how often that word comes up. Remember, let me just go back for a second. Let me go back. Okay, when I'm doing this sort of stuff, how often does the word come up in the feature? If I decide that I must give, you must extract the 10 top words from the feature, count for me how many times fortune comes up. Count for me is gain. Now you're going, now why is he doing that? Indicators. What words matter? What words can track better? What words, if I maintain a control vocabulary, a subset of words, would do a better job of discriminating the topics that are relevant or that I'm interested in, and not the entire dictionary. So what's interesting is when I do the higher constraint, notice that, wow, these words really are coming up, not all of them, but the majority of them, and boy, they come up strong. The high entropy words were conserved better with the higher sparsity constraint on the features. Interesting, because maybe what we're able to do then is to identify these tracker words, and then if I'm in a surveillance world, Those are the words I should be looking for first, perhaps. Now you could argue, well, there's other words you haven't even gotten to yet. Sure. But we're looking for fast scans. Just like when you look through documents, something we were talking about at lunch of this. I mean, when you look through documents, after you read carefully maybe one or two or three, but after 10 or 20, you're looking for a word to see if it's relevant. I mean, you give up the ability to want to read everything. So this is kind of interesting to have indicator words to do that. And the color here isn't to freak you out, and it's not to propose a new pattern. It's just to show you coverage, okay? California topics, collapse, Texas football, India. And it was just to show that you're seeing coverage of those different topics, constraining higher, okay, and conserving high entropy words. All right, so watch my time here. We tried something else. We thought, you know, that was just all words. David Skillicorn, this is another group that's done a lot of interesting work with the Enron data set at Queen's University, and we collaborated them on a little bit about paying attention to particular word types, in this case, nouns. In other words, what would you gain if you only looked at nouns, a very, again, smaller subset of words? And so they had already parsed it, so we took their parsing of an email set that's a little bit bigger than what we were just showing you with the private set. These mail emails go through all the mail folders, up to 289,000 emails. And I was interested, again, my same experiments, look at smoothing on that W for an approximate N of F with the smoothing on W. It's an L2 norm constraint. And then I don't even care about H. That regularization I just threw out. I do log entropy weighting again. And again, I'll monitor the top 10 nouns. It's exactly the same experiment, but nouns. I just want to see, what, do you gain something? Do you lose something?
I understand before you write nouns too, right?
Nouns, verbs, adjectives, everything.
No, but I don't think I've seen a verb there. Well, maybe I'm wrong.
There were. You're right, good point. And here's what happened with this experiment. Again, here's the high entropy nouns that are occurring, that are available. We also provided the global frequency of those words just in case there was some interesting correlation, but it was really unusable to look at that. So same experiment, but just trying to vary the constraint on the smoothness. That this very sparse factor, more dense factor.
Okay.
I didn't parse, but
no.
I'm sorry, they're capitalized. Makes you think that unless soybeans and egg. No.
Can you go back two slides?
Sure.
Blackout stocks, UT, Chronicle.
They look like nouns, I know.
Yeah, why don't they appear in the second list?
Oh, different parsing, different emails.
Okay.
This is their parsing. So here's another interesting thing. I take someone else's parser and apply my model. I don't care. I mean, it was very nice. All I needed was a very simple frequency structure that just told me, it's basically give me the graph, give me your graph that you parsed, and I'll feed it right into the model, and that's what I did.
But this is also Enron, right?
It's Enron.
So what do you mean by British National Corps?
There's a set of the BNC is a collection of the most frequent nouns used in the English language.
I thought BNC is the collection of text.
Yes, but there's a subset of nouns that they're ranked nouns that they produce this list. I don't have the email. There's a website for this.
Uh-huh.
And they will produce for you the top ranking nouns as observed in I don't know what collections.
The British National Corps is that collection.
Or is that, it is their collection and they're ranking all the nouns.
Corpus generally means a collection of documents.
Right.
The noun list you're talking about is extracted from that corpus.
Okay.
This is what you're guessing from the name. Let's go back.
So suppose you don't do any stop lists and
sure.
Nouns.
That's what this is. This is no stop list. This is using a list of nouns.
And I suppose you would not use anything like that. Would you get a dimension which has general English, or not?
In our case, it was unconsistent.
Obviously, in every email,
I mean,
hello and hello.
This is their parsing of the B and C nouns, is what I'm saying, from Enron.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was just something that came up. So suppose you're not doing this, which again, maybe you didn't try.
No.
Okay.
This is just looking at someone else's.
How many nouns are there in the list?
Oh, 7,424 were extracted from Enron. I know this. 7,424.
Correctly, that the British National Corpus somehow puts out a list of nouns which are important to the British National Corpus.
Right.
And you are now seeing how those nouns exist in the NRAL corpus.
Yes.
Right.
Their goal was to see if the rank of nouns had some correlation to the to topics and actually deception. They were actually interested more in deception. So.
Actually, this is so I have the
okay.
So
dynamic programming. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So the list of 7,424 words comes from Killa and Skillicorn, who wrote a paper specifically about the Enron corpus, and those are the words whose frequency of use, whose rate of use in this corpus exceeds that in the British National Corpus.
Okay.
So this is actually specialized to this corpus.
I was wondering.
Oh,
okay. I mean, it was hard to read the kata.
Oh, yeah.
7,000
yeah.
most important words in the British.
No. Yeah. This is what you get, I guess, collaborating with people. And I was curious if our model was useful across other embellishments of the data set. It was just very interesting that we could get similar kinds of extractions. Actually got some new things, like something about Scotland and energy associated with that, strange real estate things. And some clusters were stronger than others. We found descriptions of India were better than others with some of these words. But generally, again, high entropy words were conserved. So I need to carefully wrap things up here. So this is an interesting aspect of looking at approximate factorizations to try to get better immediate interpretations. That was the goal here. And to look at mechanical ways of doing that. Absolutely, uniqueness is a concern. And so smoothing and again, looking at constraints on these factors, we found that constraining on the W was much more useful than the H. Perhaps making combinations of that needs to be done. We think that, why would someone care about this? In other words, again, getting aboutnesses of discussions. What you can do here is perhaps extract features, discussions, and topics without really going after, as we said earlier, the needle. We're not really interested in the needle. We really don't want to incriminate people, but we want to know, look, there's a discussion now on a lot of money or yachts or something all of a sudden. Did someone die and leave the money to someone? I mean, you see how topic and language changes and so forth. So for surveillance purposes, that's right on target. Perhaps in the industrial world, you know, assessing morale, feedback. We've established a new policy. Let's look and see how people are complaining or, you know, what are they doing? Or fantasy football, you know, how are you spending your time? We definitely, there's a lot of work that continue looking at term frequency effects, perhaps, looking at log entropy is not the only way of looking at the world. Looking at perhaps looking at this control space, looking at the parameterization on a more, you know, cause and effect way would be useful. Obviously, just like in most data mining context of clustering, you know, what's dimensionality? What does dimensionality buy for you or hurt you? This is one thing we're hoping to do. Getting an email set is one thing. Getting an email set like this is one thing. But, you know, if we don't produce better ways of having people work with it, we're not going to really advance or we're going to reinvent the wheel over and over again. So one of our goals is to use our own stuff, use our own software, use our own clustering techniques to try to produce an annotated subset. Now, some people have already done this at Berkeley, but they only annotated what kind of email is it? Is it from the boss? Is it spam? Is it that kind of thing? I want context. Can we go ahead and start labeling some of these so that people can do topic detection effectively and then look at social networking and graph theoretic aspects with context? So that's one of the goals this year, is to get a subset of Enron annotated. And Kevin Heinrich, my PhD student, is here. He's looking at the use of NMF for, as we talked a little bit before about gene classification, but this is not in context of looking at the genotypes. This is looking at how text mining of Medline and so forth could be useful as ways of producing gene classifications, and he's looking at the usage of a non-negative matrix factorization to do that. So that's in his PhD thesis. So there's certainly lots of other readings, and I do have some sample reprints of some recent articles from Information Processing Management and then some others recently. But some of this work is from spectral data analysis, and then more recently in document clustering. Context, and every talk needs to end with a commercial. Just to remind those, if you're not aware, that we have a community in SIAM, Society of Industrial and Applied Mathematics, in the text mining world. And so this year we have our text mining workshop. It's in Bethesda on April 22nd. I encourage you, if you're in the area, you do have to register for the conference, unfortunately. I got all these emails, can I just show up? And the answer is, no, I get in trouble for saying that. So you really have to register for the conference. There's the website. We had 26 papers submitted. Fantastic. We can only accept 10. But 26 papers were submitted to this conference. To attribute that, this is a different community. And I'll just say a word, and then I'm going a little bit over. This is not KDD. This is a community of applied mathematicians, statisticians, and computer scientists who are looking at sort of what I think this group is interested in, looking at how mathematics is formalized and used effectively in computability issues and scale and so forth. Okay, this is not just get out there, mine a bunch of data, and what'd you get? Okay, it's SIAM membership trying to look specifically at text mining in its own right. All right. So this is not the IRR group. This is not the SIG IR group. It's a very different group of people. But if you see yourself like me on the border of documents and space, the purple people, this is really, really a good place to consider coming and being part of this group, and encourage you to come. Okay. So with that, I will stop.